Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Four Arrows, Wahingpa Topa, whose Anglo name is Donald Trent Jacobs. He's a professor at Fielding Graduate University and formerly the Dean of Education at Oglala Lakota College on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. He was selected by the Alternative Education Resource Organization as one of 27 visionaries in education. He received the Martin Springer Institute Moral Courage Award for his indigenous-based activism and was involved in creating the first marine no-take zone on the Pacific coast of Mexico. He's an American Indian activist and author of 21 books and numerous articles and chapters about indigenous worldview applications for contemporary world issues. His most recent book is Sitting Bull's Words for a World in Crisis. In it, he shows readers how to use the, quote, cat-fawn connection, which we'll talk about later, to move from dominant to indigenous ways of understanding our place in the world, a technique Dr. Michael Fisher refers to as a dehypnotizing technology. He referred to that in Fisher's recent biography of Four Arrows entitled Fearless Engagement of Four Arrows. So first off, as always, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you again so much for being on the program.
Well, thank you for having me. I think this is our fourth or fifth time, and it's always a pleasure.
Oh, it's always a joy. Thank you. Tell me about your new book and its genesis.
Well, I have been saying in the recent years, I think it started a year and a half ago when I was presenting at the University of British Columbia, and someone asked me, so, Four Arrows, do you think if we begin to embrace our original worldview that we can turn things around? And Derek, it just came out of my mouth. I said, no. And you could just see the audience, you know, just tense up. This is before COVID, so maybe it was closer to two and a half years ago. But anyway, the logical question came right out after that. Well, then why are you doing this work? And I said, well, you know, I want to be a human being, you know, and being a human being is doing the kind of work that I'm doing to help others and adjust, you know, in this world. That was kind of what I said. And I started thinking about, you know, I guess I'm saying I don't have hope. And in that hopelessness, the sense of liberation became very, very strong. And over that time, which to whatever it's been 2 years or so since that presentation, a lot of students and people who have attended my seminars have said that first it pissed them off, you know, or something like that, but now they feel liberated. So I started to do research on a book that Darcia Narvaez and I are writing. Long story short, I was asked to write for a different publisher, a similar book. And I thought, I'm going to write one about this idea, you know, of going forward in the face of hopelessness. And I had, for the other book, I had been looking at all kinds of indigenous authors, and I'd gotten fascinated with the Lakota man, we refer to in the main English language is Sitting Bull. And as I read about him, I thought, you know, he was doing the same thing. He had no hope. The buffalo had all been killed. Smallpox had wiped out most of his people. The Europeans were coming in droves. He knew that his days were numbered. He was on the run, continually in spite of his, you know, rare resistance. But as I started to read the various biographies of him and the many interviews he did when he was in prison and when he in his, you know, little times with the Buffalo Bill show, wow! I mean, his generosity was nonstop. His humor was nonstop. His spiritual—he was mostly a sun dancer. You know, that's really how I think of him, not as a warrior. And he sun danced even when he was on the run, you know, doing prayers for the world. He was creative constantly. He was writing songs all the time. And as I was looking at this, I'm thinking, you know, he didn't stop being a human being, you know, and resisting, of course. I mean, that was part of it nonstop when everybody else was giving up. And I thought, if he can do that in that situation, you know, which, you know, is ostensibly as bad or worse than our COVID or many of the things happening, maybe not globally, you know, with climate change, but I thought, you know what? I'm going to write a book to show how he can, how that worldview precept, and I chose, I think 17 of them for that book out of the 40 that I put in my book, The Red Road. And then, you know, I talk about how you can use this mnemonic cat fawn to get to that place where he arrived, and how he implemented that particular worldview precept. So, I mean, I didn't hope that didn't go too long, but that's what, how, you know, sort of the etiology of the book.
Oh, no, please feel free to go on as long as you want. So I want to talk about cat fawn in a few minutes, but before we get there, can you share with us, say a couple, three of, one of the things one of the many things I love about the book are Sitting Bull's words themselves that you chose and then your analysis of them. And can you choose a couple, three of your favorite of the things that he said and then your, and why you think they're important and your spin on them?
Sure. I mean, you know, the first one that comes to my mind while I'm grabbing the book is, you know, the precept, the indigenous precept that is about moving from fear to courage and then to fearlessness. And his quote really itself maybe is not so powerful, but the story behind it is. His quote was, he said he was in the context, he was, you know, captured, and escaped, and he was, you know, on a desperate effort to get away when, they came upon a freshly killed buffalo, and it was their only really food that they had seen in weeks aside from some roots and stuff. So it was really life-saving, but, they realized that wolf skinners had poisoned it. And so from that, what they did was very courageous in terms of them moving on and singing and making a song, doing a ceremony and really praying for the buffalo. And the words he used that were translated when he described this to a reporter, he said, "Yeah, friends, hey, hardships pursued me. Fearless of them, I continue to live. Love of my people is the reason I'm doing this. Love of life is the reason I'm doing this." And I there's so many examples that I give about other things that he did, like getting just within shooting distance of some cavalrymen and sitting down and smoking the pipe, you know, while the bullets landed around him. This idea of fearlessness is so represented. And of course, I lived with that when I was on Pine Ridge with my Sundance brothers and sisters. That would be one. Let's see. I got the book now. I'll just thumb through and grab another one. Let's see. Here's one that says, this is about moving from a materialistic worldview to the non-materialistic worldview of Sitting Bull and our indigenous peoples that still have managed to hold on to the old ways. He says, "You hear me, friends. We have now to deal with another people, small and feeble when our forefathers first went with them, but now they're great and overbearing. Strangely enough, they have a mind to till the soil, and the love of possessions is a disease in them. These people have made many rules that the rich may break, but the poor may not." Yes, I think that shows his humor also, right? And of course, you know, this idea of soil. I recently did a presentation on soil at a university with three experts in soil. And I went last, and I had a PowerPoint where I showed Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt, Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, and Wendell Berry, three people that I really respect who were talking about the importance of soil. And in each one of the quotes, they said something to the effect of, you know, we got to take care of it so it takes care of us, you know, and for survival. And as I showed those three quotes, I said to the audience, I said, you know, I'm really honored to be with these soil engineers and experts, and what they say is so true about what's happening to our soil, et cetera. But, you know, what they're saying isn't going to do any good. That information is not going to do any good. You know, of course, everybody kind of, you know, scrunched up a little bit, and then I made a joke about it. And then I said, let me tell you why. These are three people that I really respect who have said similar things about the importance of soil. They're very, you know, very powerful people. But I said, compare that with the one you're going to see next. And then I showed one of Chief Seattle. And maybe I'll grab it for later if I can find it on my computer. But in essence, his was saying, talking about the dancing soil beneath his feet and its lovingness and how it remembers, as does he, the times that came before and nurtures the blood of his ancestors. And in other words, it was just, you know, very, very different. And when I asked the audience, does anybody see the difference? Everybody raised their hand just about, and even ones I hadn't thought of were, but they all were about the relational, you know, the earth as an unloving it was not the perspective. It was earth and all of its systems is living and loving you know, and so, you know, that's kind of how we take off on some of these quotes.
So I have to admit to you that, I kind of set you up by asking for the quotes because I was hoping in my heart that you would choose the one about tilling the soil, the one you just did.
Well, so, you had one out of seven. You had one out of like, what, 18 chances on that. So that's pretty good odds. But I think spirit works synchronistically between us, Derek. It always has.
Yeah. And one of the things I love about that quote is, and I'm not trying to take away from the absolute importance of the soil being alive, because it is the most important thing on the land. I mean, if the soil isn't happy, then nobody's happy. And I love the fact that we in this culture perfectly accept plowing as an absolutely normal thing, but it is utterly atrocious. And it's skinning the planet alive. So I love that he denormalized it.
Yeah, didn't he? And kind of with a tongue in cheek sense of humor and making some real clear, frank statements that we go, whoa, I guess that's true, right? I remember, you know, with what you just said, Bill Moyer, do you remember his documentary many years ago called Earth on Edge, where he interviewed three Kansas wheat farmers, two of which were doing tilling of the soil and one which was not. And, they are huge farms, you know, 10,000 acres or more. And he asked the farmer that was doing the organic approach, are you making as much money as the two guys who are doing the tilling and using all this fertilizer, which you're not using? And of course, Bill Moyer would every once in a while flash to the Gulf of Mexico to show how the Mississippi River Delta was creating death zones, all, you know, like huge death zones, the first of the death zones that were being advertised. So anyway, he asked the two guys that were using the fertilizers, why do you use this when you're not making that much more profit and you have to use more and more fertilizer because your soil is dying and your neighbor, you know, doesn't? And long story short, I think there were two or three answers. One of them was they couldn't buy tractors or get loans or anything like that from the bank unless they were using fertilizing and tilling. That was in the loan, you know, that the, that the big guys in the corporations that were selling that stuff got banks to say, hey, you know, if they're not using this, they're not going to be a good risk. So the banks themselves were contributing. The other one was less because what my daddy did. And the third one was, you know, major, advertisements and taking some people and, you know, fixing them up with dates and good deals, right? But I remember walking away from that thinking, those are the three things that are killing us. So it's a good choice that we did on the soil for sure.
So let's sort of move to the heart of this and talk about cat fawn. It's, and I need to say to people, it's all caps, CAT-FAWN. So what the heck is that?
Well, when I got out of the Marine Corps back in 1969, I had a big chip on my shoulder, Vietnam chip. And I tried to get rid of it by doing, dramatic kinds of athletic endeavors. And I was a firefighter at the time, and I asked Dave Carr, a friend of mine, if he'd like to try to be the first to ascend the Rio Urique River in central Mexico. And in fact, if the folks want to see the entire story in photographs and narrative, just put in the shaman's message in YouTube, and you can watch the whole thing. Long story short, I had a near-death experience on the river. And after the near-death experience, Rarámuri Indians helped us climb out of this 8,000-foot canyon, because it was the Rio Urique in central Mexico, which is deeper than the Grand Canyon. And as we were coming out, we got lost, and we never would have made it. It kept coming into dead-end barrancas and stuff like that. But the young Indians kept showing up from, turned out to be, miles and miles and miles and miles away to mark a trail for us. And one day he had a dead fawn, F-A-W-N, over his shoulders, that the feet were bleeding. They're such great runners. He literally ran it down until his feet were bleeding. And then, conked it to take it back to his village. Then, earlier, right before that, Dave and I had escaped into a cave as the river was rising. And the water kept coming up, and we kept climbing up until we were on the top shelf, not knowing if we would drown, when a onsa, which is a mountain lion, walked over our two sleeping bags on this narrow ledge. And, we were like a couple of kids, and I holy shit, Dave, did a mountain lion just walk over our sleeping bag, that kind of stuff, right? But we all of a sudden realized he disappeared, and so he gave us the way out. I had a vision the next day or two of these two animals, after seeing the one with the guy, the Rarámuri carrying it, I had a vision that turned it from the animals into neon lights, with the big capital letters. And long story short, after that, I spent a long time, many years, including going and getting a second doctorate to understand it. And here's what it means. Cat, think of it as spontaneous hypnosis. Think of it as mass hypnosis and why we do things like pollute our water and pollute our air, which couldn't be more illogical. How else can you explain them besides it being some phenomenon that we could use the word hypnosis or trance-based learning to describe? Cat, meaning concentration activated transformation, is how indigenous people kept themselves in harmony via ceremony. Ceremony is really just a trance-based learning exercise. And without knowing the terms of hypnosis and brainwave frequencies, they knew with intention and with focus and imagining what outcome they wanted, whether it was to be more generous or to hunt better, ceremonies were used continually, but they were a cat phenomenon. All creatures become hypersuggestible to the instructions of a perceived trusted authority figure during times of stress. And if you go on YouTube, since we're talking about YouTube, put in wild horse hypnotist, and you'll see how I learned this from wild horses. And so think about how, when a young child who's in hypnosis the first 5 years of their life, just about, they're in brainwave frequency, alpha and lower. And that's why they can learn so many languages. Well, think of a teacher comes up to them and says, you're never going to amount to anything, right? And how that can have a long-term thing. So Cat lets us know that there's our reasons we believe things that are not good for us that we can come back and look at if we understand this phenomenon of hypnosis. And also, once we understand the cause of it, we can use self-hypnosis, because all hypnosis is self-hypnosis. You don't need to be paying somebody like me who taught it at UC Berkeley $300 an hour. You can do this yourself. And so you can do it yourself to transform away from these brain synapses that have programmed us to be doing things on the wrong side of the worldview chart. Okay. So that's Cat. Go ahead.
So I've got a couple more questions before you go to Fawn.
Good.
One of them is, I remember when I read Lewis Mumford, I loved so much of what he said, but at the time I read it, I was still in my 30s, and he hated rock music, and I objected to that. And then a little bit later, a few years later, I saw a video of AC/DC, the band, playing at Rio del Plata, and you have 100,000 young people all pulsating and chanting to the words, I'm on the highway to hell. And this, I suddenly got his analysis, and I was thinking about power chords and how they can open us up. And that can be a wonderful thing within a community where you are attempting to mend the community or something. But also when you have when it's done irresponsibly, that can be really scary, because communal singing is a profound communion. And then also I'm thinking about television and just how, I'm just meandering.
Actually, in my original book, on this trip into Copper Canyon, it's called Primal Awareness, a true story that Inner Traditions published back in 1998. I use music as part of Fawn, the W in words, because music has always been a powerful form of communication for indigenous people. And then afterwards, when colonization started, it was used, you know, it was used in the Marine Corps to get me gung ho, right? You know, the marching music and what we know, you know, in the Marines, that people put earphones on in battle with hard rock music that is instigating the emotions to kill. And then music can also have, you know, very healing. There's a lot of, therapies that use music for healing. And so music, you know, is a important part of both the hypnotic phenomenon, which, you know, is inseparable from the fear, authority, words, and nature aspects of life, which is, you know, what the Fawn represented. So I think it's good to bring that up. And I'm a musician myself, and I know that I can have different moods listening or playing music. And I think that, music is a part, and drumming is a part of have been parts of ceremonies for, hundreds of thousands of years in our indigenous culture.
And I want to say one more thing, which is, I was talking to Jeanette Armstrong way back in the 1990s, and she said that something she was going to have to do that weekend was go help a woman who had been abused. And she got away from her abuser, and she was working on healing. And one of the things Jeanette said to me was, so when I'm up there, we're going to use some specific symbols and tones that will basically allow us to interact more directly with her psyche, such that we can accomplish, we hope, in a weekend what might take 10 years of therapy. And the point was that there are, I'm just validating what you're saying, of there are ways that specific, I don't know, symbols or there are ways that there are ways of imparting knowledge, both for good and for bad, that are far beyond what we think about on a day-to-day basis, most of us.
Right. And words are probably the most powerful in the English language, which is a noun-based language. They are symbolic concretations of ideas that have been, you know, programmed in us. Whereas in indigenous languages, it's really hard to concretize anything, because like if you ask what kind of tree is that, you can't say it's an oak tree. You got to know whether the wind's blowing, whether there's a nest in it, you know, whether it's what time of year it is, etc. Right. And so, but in addition to words, which are symbols, there are many other kinds of symbols that have this. And in terms of the musical tones, this gets into the idea of understanding hypnosis. Really, when I taught it at UC Berkeley, I would just say, look, all it is believing in an image deeply while you are out of beta, which you and I are in right now, while you're in a lower brainwave frequency. Alpha is sufficient. I mean, I had my appendix taken out with alpha without using any anesthesia at Kaiser. And so, you know, it's such a powerful tool, but it's been taken away from us, and it's been given to, you know, only professionals who can use it, or all the Abrahamic religions say it's of the devil. So even though they use it themselves, they don't let anybody else use it. Salesmen use it, right? I mean, there's strategies they use, the double bind strategy, which can be used to save someone's life. As I write in my Prentice Hall book, Patient Communication, you come up to somebody and say, would you be more comfortable with your arm at your side or on your belly? You know, somebody that's in glass and blood. And they will choose one or the other if they're in spontaneous hypnosis. Then you can just go ahead and say, well, good, let that comfort begin to move through your body. And when I count to three, let your blood pressure start to go down. And, you know, I mean, it's these kinds of processes are so natural to us. And, you know, Einstein said imagination is more powerful than knowledge, but we've lost them. And so Kat is bringing it back into our control. And, you know, with a piece of dental floss and a paperclip, your audience can just have their elbow on a table and hold the paperclip just a quarter inch above the table and imagine it going around. And if they don't think about it or challenge themselves as they're doing it or be freaked out when it happens, which happens a lot, the ideomotor neurons in your fingertips will actually move the pendulum in the direction they see, and it'll get stronger and stronger the more they concentrate. Well, that's just how the body works. Edmund Jacobson figured that out in 1939 with tennis players. But the trick is, now you just paid the equivalent of $300 for somebody, to hypnotize you. You're in hypnosis. Now all you got to do is double task and have a clearly, not to think about directive, to also imagine while the pendulum is still going, because that means you're in an alpha brainwave frequency. So, I mean, it's such a simple thing, and yet it requires the skill of knowing through the metacognitive reflection of fear, authority, words, and nature. What am I afraid of that has caused this problem? On whose authority do I have the problem? What words do I use to describe the problem, and are they accurate and honest? And how have I not, or have I used nature as a teacher? And you take those things and you combine them. You know, this is like one of my students now is doing courses at catfawn.com on using a video work that I've done to try to certify people in catfawn. He just started it. But I just read an article that came out that's by Liliette Vasseur, who's the UNESCO chair in sustainability, and in it she's saying that she quotes what I quoted in my article in The Nation on what the media missed from the biodiversity report from the United Nations about 1 million more species going extinct, etc. And here they repeat that, the saying, worldview is what it is. And changing our worldview is the most urgent course of action we must undertake to cease acting on the world in a destructive way. That's the last sentence in their UNESCO chair of sustainability paper. And yet they don't know how to do it, right? So I'm putting out in the Sitting Bull's words book, which we managed to get, you know, for under $20, because that was the deal I made with the publisher, that each one of the scenarios on how to move into that worldview, a simple little exercise on how Cat Fawn will work. And if we can get enough people doing it, maybe we, you know, future generations will pick it up when we rebuild, huh?
So let's talk about some of the specific chapters / worldviews that need to be changed, and how Cat Fawn could let's go through that process for you. Just choose one of the topics and say where we are, where we should be, if should is the right word, and how Cat Fawn would get us there.
Sure. Well, I mean, maybe one of the most easy to understand. I mean, I'll just really quickly just read a few of what we're talking about. I'll start with the common dominant worldview. You see, under this theory, Derek, I use Robert Redfield, a father of social anthropology from the University of Chicago, who said there's only two worldviews. There were three that included the East, but it got subsumed by the Western one. And that there's only really two major worldviews. They're much deeper than a culture. And under each worldview are a great diversity of cultures, beliefs, philosophies, you know, spiritual traditions, right? So under the common dominant worldview is hierarchical. Common indigenous worldview is non-hierarchical, right? Fear-based thoughts and behaviors versus courage and fearless trust in the universe. Materialistic versus non-material. Earth is a unloving it to earth as all systems is living and loving. More head than heart, more heart than head. Lacking empathy, empathetic, etc. Right. So there's 40 of them that are I think easy to find in my work. But anthropocentrism versus animistic or biocentrism is probably one of the most important ones, if we could say it. So, this idea of being human centered, you know, this idea of a strictly humanistic approach to life in this foundational understanding that we have, it's what's killing us. And in fact, some of my colleagues at the university have a chapter that came out recently called Anthropocentrism is Killing Us. So if we talk about that, you know, somebody wants to deal with COVID, in a way that's actually constructive. And so they do a little bit of research, and, you know, it doesn't take much to do it on even Google and to be able to pick out what's bullshit and what makes sense. They're going to start seeing, well, wait a minute. We go back to the 13th century pandemic. We go to 1918 pandemic. They're caused by deforestation, essentially, and how that causes different animal groups to be together that shouldn't be, including our animal group with the others. And so we go, wow. So you start with that and you go, well, why are we so cruel to other than human sentience, you know, including trees and plants and insects and birds. And they come just to a cognitive realization. Wow. You know, we should have more respect for non-humans. We're not such, so we shouldn't be so arrogant. So now they're at that stage of the metacognitive part using Fawn, and you can do that with Fawn. By asking whenever you start to deal with a problematic, whether it's a personal one or the global one, what is it how fear caused this? What is it that relates to us having fear? And you come up to a lot of answers, right? I wish we had time to go through the whole thing. We also have then on whose authority are the beliefs that we're operating under? that natural resources are, strictly for, humans. I wrote a book with, Walter Block, the endowed professor at Loyola, who is Ron Paul's guru. He's a, calls himself a Jewish libertarian. And I invited him to write a book with me. Because I disagreed with everything he said. I said, let's see if we can find common ground. I gave a copy to Alice Walker, who's my neighbor down here in Mexico. She threw it in the trash and said I was in bed with the devil. So I disagree with her on that. But I learned from him that he truly believes, and the capitalistic system truly believes, that everything on earth is for the sake of human beings, right? So this is the anthropocentrism. And it doesn't take too much to get to saying, okay, I get that. But how do we get to where we start respecting the wisdom of a cockroach or an ant? You know, that's another step, isn't it? Or we talk to a tree like we do at our sun dances, right? And ask permission to be able to cut it down. So it gives its life to us for being able to continue on in a good way. How do we get there? Well, we got to figure out, what's the authority that gives me the belief I have? So now we've moved into the authority. And then, because words are so powerful, Kipling says they're mankind's most powerful drug, what words do I use? Well, words, if somebody came to me, a woman, say, who was obese and wanted to lose weight, and I said, what do you say if you're naked looking into the mirror? And she says, I'm fat, you know? I'd say, we got to get accurate here. That's what, it's all about accuracy and truth as best we can probability it. And I said, yeah, if you were fat, you'd be in a jar, right? And so then eventually she says, well, okay, I'm a beautiful woman who happens to have more adipose tissue on me than I feel is healthy or desirable. Oh, good. That's progress, right? So now you got new words to work with, right? And so you can dehypnotize yourself via the words you've been using. Because we use words all the time. I've had people that come to me when I was in practice, executives who sweat under their arms every time they go to a meeting. And I just ask them, what do you say right before the meeting? And they say, I have to be on time. I said, change it to I want and call me back and we'll see if you really still need to come for hypnosis. And invariably they would call back and say, you must have hypnotized me. You're on the phone. I said, no, this is you're stressed, which means you're in hypnosis probably. And then you say, I have to, and bingo. That's very different than I want to. This is how, Derek, this is how simple this is in a way, right? And then, of course, after the words, before you go and do this cat and start to transform yourself, go out. And even if you're in a concrete jungle, go find a pigeon or some weeds coming out of the cracks in the sidewalk or an insect and study it. Study it with the mindset that it is a teacher. That's how we live for 99% of human history. And do that and then come back and let the intuitiveness of that be a part of that metacognitive reality you now have from having gone through fawn. And now, and realizing that cat brought you to a lot of it, inadvertently. And now sit down. Get your pendulum out or go on the YouTube and find a million ways to do self-hypnosis and allow yourself to go into hypnosis with the right imagery, positively phrased words. Like a golfer can't say, I'm not going to hit the ball in the sand trap, because those words will prevail he'll hit it. He'll say, I'm going to hit it into the fairway, right? So sit down and do that and allow yourself to just go into that alpha state as you believe in that image. And then as soon as you can, do an in vivo, what we call an in vivo exposure. That means go out and practice some evidence for it, some proof. Some proof that you now see non-humans in a very different way, right? And then keep doing the practice. The better you get at it, the more you transform. We did, this David Levine, just did a 8-week class, twice, 2 days a week, on this cat fawn after the first one ever done. We just finished it about 2 weeks ago. And, of the 17, students that are, there are people from different walks of life around the world, very talented people actually. they, I got 9 letters back saying that it was completely transformative, which is, you know, which is the experience that I've had with it, you know, personally over the years.
One of the things that I love about everything you're saying is that it, for me at least, really demystifies all of these processes. Like when you say, you know, find a pigeon, find some weeds in the sidewalk, it really is, I mean, you don't have to go out and then go, oh, this is my spiritual teacher and make this, you know, big deal of it. It's simply in many ways just taking a walk and being present on the walk and being present to the pigeon and having the faith that the pigeon is just another being.
Exactly. Another being, and some one that has been here maybe before you and has survived in ways that you don't know. So I add the teacher quality to that, that there's something to be learned, which, you know, you can say for other human beings as well, but other human beings can be, you know, much more deceptive or incorrect. You know, you're not going to find a pigeon that's not doing his best unless it's in a cage necessarily, right? I mean, I think we only have a minute left, but I'll just give you an example how powerful that is.
We still have 5 or 6 minutes. We're good.
Oh, good. All right. Well, I won't rush it so much as I've been talking so fast. Okay. So I remember I was going for my last Sundance, and I was no longer living on Pine Ridge. I was now up at altitude in Idaho in cool weather. And I heard on the radio that the temperature for the Sundance was going to be 114 degrees in South Dakota. And I was not acclimated in it like I was in previous Sundances. And I told my wife, I said, I don't know, I can go 4 days without water. And she said, well, you going up on the mountain? I said, yeah. So I went up from what we call an ombleche, a crying for a vision, literal translation. And I put my tobacco ties in a circle and I sat inside of it. I sang my Lakota songs. And right away, a rat-like creature came out of the woods and the weeds that I had made a little clearing and started eating some of the tobacco out of one of the ties. And I just reactively kind of kicked it away out of my circle. And as soon as I did, I realized how stupid I had been. You know, my gosh, this was probably the vision. Now I'm going to be up there for another 23.5 hours or more. And I'm not going to get a vision. You know, I'm thinking those kinds of ways, right? I was now in Idaho in a different mindset, and I hadn't gotten settled into this alternative reality. But thank goodness it came back. About 5 minutes later, it just walked in, waltzed in, started eating some tobacco, and it turned and sat down in the center of this maybe 3 feet diameter circle of tobacco ties. Like a mascot or a pet dog. And now I knew that this was it. Well, long story short, I didn't have any knowledge about flora and fauna in Idaho. And I didn't have a medicine person that had that special knowledge around. So what did I think of? I can't wait to get down and go to Google on the computer, right? And so I come back, I make my fire for the lodge. And I can't talk to my wife until I'm done with that, and I burn my clothes and stuff. But I go on Google and I put in rodents of North America, and I find this thing. It was a kangaroo rat, and it had a Latin name, I remember. And it said, and what it said was, quote, "The only mammal in North America that can go a lifetime without a drop of water." And my fear was that, you know, when you do the dance, you're out in the sun from sun up to sundown. You're not drinking water for 4 days. And here I go up and so there's a lot of synchronicity involved with it as well. Not just the learning, you know, of watching, a bunch of birds doing something or a line of ants, right? And really focusing on their sentient potential that you never thought of before. But there's often times that there will be something, if you go and learn about that animal, if you go learn about that that creature. You will, you know, something will happen. Something will happen. And you can Google it, you know, learn about it. And it's going to connect you and go, oh my gosh, that relates exactly to the problem I'm talking about, you know. So everybody should be using that should word. It's best if everybody really, starts to get out of this human centeredness. And that includes, reading, if you need to read Western books, you can read, you know, like The Secret Life of Trees and look at the rooted ones, right? But giving appreciation for them every morning, you know, like 25% of indigenous days are spent in giving and thank you. And that's for people that still hold on to it. And I reckon there's probably over 60% of our American Indian, brothers and sisters now, that we've lost touch with ceremonies. We've become missionaryized in one way or the other. So we've got to also at the same time do what we can to stop the genocide against those few cultures and groups and cultures around the world who are still, holding on to these ways. But in the meantime, that's place-based knowledge, which I'm ignorant of because I don't speak fluently and I wasn't raised with the traditional values, etc. But, worldview belongs to all of us. And even though in Indian country is divided on who can teach it, the people like, that Fools Grow and White Standing Buffalo and Rick Two Dogs that I respect all say, no, we're all in this together. And this is something we all need to be working on.
So I love the bit about I love everything you said, and I'm thinking about the kangaroo rat, and it reminds me of one of my favorite lines I've ever written, which is I don't remember the line though exactly. It's basically that we misperceive the world because we should perceive the world more like we perceive our dreams, by which I don't mean not real, but by which I mean full of meaning. So if I see a horse in a dream, if I see a horse when I'm just driving down the road, it's like, oh, it's another stupid horse. Who cares? But if I see a horse in a dream, it's like, what does that horse mean to me? What are the memories associated with it? What do horses mean symbolically? And I mean, you could easily have just gone, oh, it's another stupid rat, but it ends up that this is, that if you saw a rat in a dream, you would have known. But all we need to do in many ways is just convert our perspective on how we perceive dreams as full of meaning. Here's what I'm trying to say. Sorry it took me so long. Is that the world is full of meaning.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if we have a worldview, this is this fundamental way that we conceptualize reality that is unconscious mostly. If we have a worldview that denies what you just said, if we have a worldview that doesn't allow for that, then no matter how, you know, much we want to save the planet, if we're, you know, in that group, it's not going to work, right? And so, what can be more important or more influential than the way a person or a community or a nation or a culture or a world conceptualizes reality? And that's, you know, I don't like the German word Weltanschauung for worldview. Because, you know, from the indigenous perspective, we don't see the world. We experience it. But the word is being used more and more by scholars to go deeper and deeper, like the UNESCO article that I commented on, right? And so I think if we don't start doing worldview reflection, which Edgar Mitchell, the astronaut, the seventh man to walk on the moon, said, is not only did he say that that's the most important thing, and right now the Institute of Noetic Sciences that he created is the first to start kindergartners on worldview reflection. And it's not a coincidence that Edgar Mitchell said only a handful of visionaries understand that our solutions for sustainability rest in our original indigenous worldview. And I think that's what we've somehow got to get past our arrogance and thinking that that we are romanticizing the indigenous to say that, because it belongs to all of us.
Well, and it's simply true that the Talawa Indians lived and continue to live here. They lived in this place for 12,000 years and at least, and the place wasn't trashed. And the dominant culture has been here for 180, and the place is really trashed. So no matter what else you think of them, you cannot deny that they lived here for 12,000 years at least without trashing the place.
Absolutely. And, you know, and that's what this, you know, in 2019, when the biodiversity, you know, United Nations biodiversity report came out, it was on the front page of every paper in the world saying there's going to be a million more species of flora and fauna that will go extinct in a generation. And boy, then it was gone. It was gone. But I got the document, right? And I read it. And when I read seven times in that document, Derek, they said things like, and this is a quote, "Nature managed by indigenous people who possessed their original worldview is all under increasing pressure, but is generally declining much less rapidly." And then there was another place in it where it said extinction rates were non-existent or severely reduced. But they talked about worldview, and I couldn't find anybody talking about it. So I sent it to the editor of The Nation, and I said, you know, somebody's got to do this. And they wrote it. And if you Google it, it's just what the media missed from the UN report. Right. And so, yeah, so I think this is definitely one of our more important interviews, Derek.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you for all your work in the world. And thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Four Arrows. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.